In this part of Focus, we will be looking at a question that is one of the more perplexing of American history over the last couple of decades. The question being, why is it that the United States decided to fight a major war in Vietnam? Now, there is a standard view, a common explanation for that, and that holds that the United States went to war to prevent a communist takeover of Southeast Asia. It's the classic domino theory. The concern was if the United States didn't stand against communism in Vietnam, that it would spread from there elsewhere, and who knows where we would end up. We'll talk this morning, though, with an historian who takes another view. His name is Gareth Porter, and we'll be talking about some of the ideas you will find in his recent book, Perils of Dominance. The subtitle of the book is Imbalance of Power and the Road to War in Vietnam, in which he makes the argument that, in fact, we are not talking about here a classic power conflict between two major superpowers in a bipolar world. He says, in fact, the United States was not motivated by worries over communist power. It was, in fact, motivated by the perception of communist weakness. We'll talk more about that as we cover this ground in this part of Focus 580. And, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call with questions or with comments. All we ask of callers is that people are just brief. We ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. But, of course, callers are welcome with their questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 here, and toll-free 800-222-9455. So at some point here you want to join us, you can do that. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, Gareth Porter. He's an independent scholar on issues of war and peace. He's also an historian of the Vietnam conflict. From 1974 through 1976, when he was working on his PhD at Cornell, he was co-director of the Indochina Resource Center in Washington, D.C., that carried out research on the war and lobbied for an end to U.S. military involvement in Indochina. His first book, A Peace Denied, told the story of the negotiation and implementation of the Paris Peace Agreement of January 1973. That book came out in 1975. He edited a two-volume documentary history of the Vietnam conflict from 1941 onward, and that came out in 1979. He's also done an analysis of the political system of United Vietnam. That's Vietnam, the Politics of Bureaucratic Socialism, that was published in 1993. And the book that we're talking about here this morning, The Perils of Dominance, is published by the University of California Press. Gareth Porter is joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Porter, hello.
Thank you very much, David. I'm glad to participate in your program, and I want everybody to know that I am a University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana alumna.
All right. Alumnus. Well, it's nice to see people graduate from the U of I and go on and make something of themselves. So we much appreciate you giving us some of your time. And perhaps the place to start is just as to set up the basic argument, and that is, and set it aside, the one that we have all heard so often, and I mentioned it, and you can comment further on it if you like, but indeed the conventional wisdom about Vietnam was indeed what the United States was concerned about was communism. And the spread of communism around the world, but there on the local level from Vietnam elsewhere. And then there were people who made the argument at the time, if we don't stop the communists in South Vietnam, then they'll be stepping onto the beach in California before we know it. Your argument is that's not it at all. And that, in fact, it does indeed have a lot to do with the perception of some people in the United States, particularly in the Pentagon and the security advisors to the president, not that the communists were strong, but that the communists were weak.
That's exactly right. And, of course, there's no doubt that the advisors to the three presidents who are closely associated with the U.S. path to war in Vietnam, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, were strongly anti-communist in their orientation, but specifically in terms of their understanding of the situation in Southeast Asia, it's clear from the historical record that they didn't really see an onrushing red tide, if you will, in the region. That in fact they were quite well aware that. That this was a region that was not under siege. In fact, the communist movements in Southeast Asia, in the Philippines, in Burma, and in Malaya had receded tremendously from the early 1950s. They were virtually extinct by the time that the U.S. government was considering a military intervention in Vietnam. It was exactly the opposite of the image that we've gotten over the years of the U.S. view of communism in Southeast Asia. So, yes, I mean, what I found was really striking in the historical record was that, in fact, the Pentagon and the National Security Council advisors to the president in each of these three administrations were quite clear that the Soviet Union was much, you know, was not only much weaker than the United States, but was intimidated by the United States military power. And the same thing was true of China, of communist China as well. And this, you know, I think what has been missing in the understanding of the context of Vietnam is that the imbalance of power that really existed exerted a great deal of influence over the calculations of those three administrations.
Hmm. And particularly, I think you make the argument that in all of these cases, again, with Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, that they really struggled against their own national security advisors.
Yes. I mean, this is a theme that I must admit surprised me. Mm-hmm. When I started researching this book, I did have the kernel of the idea that there was an imbalance of power, and that was my hypothesis on which I which I investigated, but I was not really prepared for the degree to which I found that Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, all three, were extremely not just skeptical about the notion of intervening militarily in Vietnam, but outright opposed. I mean, all three of them were really quite strongly resistant to the some of their advisors who suggested a military intervention on the grounds of that this was a great target of opportunity, that we could win a great victory there. And I think Eisenhower of the three was most vehement about this. I mean, the record is really replete with statements by Eisenhower, both publicly and privately, that he thought it would be a great tragedy and a terrible thing for the United States to intervene. But both Eisenhower, but both Kennedy and Johnson also, on the record, made statements indicating that they were quite resistant. And the interesting thing is that it was their civilian advisors in particular, in the case of both Kennedy and Johnson, who were pushing for war. That McNamara and Robert S. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense for both presidents, and McGeorge Bundy, the National Security Advisor, the White House National Security Advisor, were both instrumental in pushing both Kennedy and Johnson towards going to war. And in both cases, they resisted for a long period of time, for many months, and then finally made essentially compromises with their advisors to do part of what they wanted or to at least agree in principle that they would do what they wanted. In both cases, I think that's really the genesis of the Vietnam tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Why were the security advisors so intent?
Well, this is really a very important and interesting question, and I offer a hypothesis here, which I think needs to be further researched, both in terms of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and later administrations, and that is that civilian advisors, in a situation of unipolar power, that is to say, the United States really being the only power that has the ability to intervene in a foreign conflict because it has military dominance, both globally and regionally. In that situation, the civilian advisors who are, day-to-day have the responsibility for the care and tending of the U.S. power position in the world, if you will, are the ones who are most deeply affected by the imbalance of power. That is to say, they make calculations on the basis of the weakness of the people they defined as their enemies. And in that situation, they are prone to making judgments about the value of using force that that are, you know, essentially regard the use of military power as an instrument of foreign policy rather than a last resort. In other words, it becomes very attractive. It becomes a temptation to use military force under those circumstances. And I think we've seen the same pattern being duplicated under the current administration, where a group of policymakers, again, in a situation of U.S. military dominance, saw military force as a useful tool for foreign policy to achieve a greater U.S. military political military power position in the Middle East. So I see a lot of parallels there between the situation that existed during the 1950s and early 1960s and the situation that we've faced in the last few years.
Yeah, I'm glad you get that point, because it's something that sooner or later I know that we'll be talking about, because I knew that indeed you do feel that there are parallels.
Absolutely. I think they're very important.
Yeah. Let me very quickly introduce again our guest. We're talking with Gareth Porter. He's an independent scholar on issues of war and peace and also historian of the Vietnam conflict, and has written a number of books on it. And one that's just out now is titled Perils of Dominance. The subtitle is Imbalance of Power and the Road to War in Vietnam. And this book is published by the University of California Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Again, I think if you look back to the sort of conventional way of thinking about the power struggle during the way people thought about it during the Cold War was that there were these two superpowers, the Soviet Union and the United States, that roughly balanced one another in their military capability, to the point that both sides knew that it would be extremely destructive to go to war directly with one another. And so what happened was that they managed to play out their rivalry in a lot of smaller conflicts, various places around the world. That was the big conflict writ small, and that's the way you look at
Vietnam. That's exactly right. And in other words, the idea that Vietnam was a proxy war between the two superpowers in this Cold War, and you know, the problem is that for during that period of the Cold War, really both the Soviet Union and the United States almost conspired implicitly or tacitly with one another to tell their own publics that, in fact, it was a bipolar struggle between two roughly equal superpowers. They both had an interest in conveying that image to their own publics for different reasons. For the United States, it was obviously important to have that notion be conveyed to the public in order to justify these Cold War programs, particularly military programs, but CIA covert operations around the world and so forth. For the Soviets, of course, it was status and also sort of a means of boosting their own security. They felt that to the degree that they could pretend that they were equal to the United States, maybe the United States would be less likely to attack them. So both sides, in fact, had different interests, but they coincided, or they converged in a sense, in convincing their own people and the rest of the world that it was a bipolar balance of power. Hmm. But it wasn't true.
Well, one of the things that seems to have come out after the Cold War, as historians and political scientists were looking back retrospectively, was that it seemed that the United States and our security analysis apparatus, like the CIA and so forth, had in fact done a very poor job of assessing Soviet strength, and that we had overassessed. We had thought that Soviets militarily were stronger than they were. And so, again, sort of the conventional wisdom is, but we really didn't know that then. We only learned it now that we have the opportunity to see.
It's a very interesting question. Yeah. You know, was the U.S. intelligence really very far off?
Yeah.
What I found was that, for the most part, the CIA was pretty close to the mark in terms of their assessment of Soviet power. They were quite objective. The Air Force, on the other hand, you know, was pushing for the idea that the Soviets were threatening to have a bomber gap or a missile gap in their favor. They were always pushing that line in order to, you know, increase the number of missiles and bombers that the Air Force would be able to procure. And so they put pressure on the intelligence community to boost the estimate of Soviet strategic power. But the CIA, you know, and the CIA did make compromises at certain points, but very quickly, as soon as they got information that contradicted that, that was factored into the estimate. And in both cases, in the bomber gap in the mid-1950s and the case of the missile gap in the late 50s, early 60s, you know, the CIA and President Eisenhower, I would add, were very clear that, in fact, that there was no threat of a Soviet even achieving equality with the United States, much less being superior to the United States. And I document the fact that at no time from 1953 to 1965 did the United States government, in terms of its intelligence estimate, believe that the Soviet Union had even a second strike strategic capability, that the Soviets were basically helpless in any threatened war between the United States and the Soviet Union.
So anybody who would make the argument was that they would say something like, sure, after the Cold War, we knew that they weren't as strong as we had thought. But at the time, we didn't know that. You're saying that, in fact, at the time, there were people who did know that.
Absolutely. Up to the time the United States intervened in Vietnam. Now, after 1965, that situation began to change gradually, and by the late 1960s, it's clear the Soviets did have a second strike capability, and that really did change the dynamics of international politics between the United States and the Soviet Union, and that was reflected in various parts of the world. But from 1953 to 1965, it's very clear that that the Soviets were really so on the defensive in the world, and in particularly in Southeast Asia, that they were essentially appeasing the United States, saying, here, you take Vietnam and Southeast Asia, we're not interested in challenging you at all. They sent very clear messages to that effect, both to the United States and to the Vietnamese communists, saying, don't do anything to disrupt the status quo.
We have a caller to bring in the conversation, and certainly others who are listening are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone here listening in Charleston, and that's line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could care to comment about the relative ability of the CIA and the KGB to, as well as the military intelligence arms in both countries, to accurately assess the other's military capability. And the reason why I ask this is that in the late 1980s, I think it was late 1988, I was working for a defense contractor and attended a classified briefing that the Air Force put on where they did a red, yellow, green assessment of military capabilities of the Soviet Union versus the United States, red being strong Russian dominance, which they attributed most especially to land army, tanks, aircraft, and so forth. And it seems, my recollection of it seems to be that the only area that they attributed the United States of having clear superiority to the Russians, and mind you, this was only a few months before the Berlin Wall came down, was in the area of space and computer technology. So I'd like to hear what your comment is.
You know, I'm certainly not an expert on that period by any means, but I would say, you know, that it's very important to recall that just around that time that the intelligence community was, the CIA in particular, was really under assault from the right. Right-wing political groups in this country who were basically arguing that the CIA was too soft on the Soviets, which is, of course, absurd. The idea that the CIA would have a bias in favor of, or, you know, sort of failing to recognize adequately Soviet power or underestimating Soviet power. But that was clearly a ploy by the right to discredit an institution that was standing in the way of the policy that they wanted, which was to take, you know, a much more, to spend a lot more on strategic power. And of course, you know, the idea was to try to spend the Soviets into oblivion. You know, that was, you know, part of the strategy that went with that.
Well, arguably, it worked.
It worked. It did work. I agree with that. It did work. But part of the strategy that went with that was to discredit any intelligence estimate that suggested that the Soviets were, you know, essentially that there was equivalence between the two military forces in terms of strategic power. So, you know, I think that's a dominant theme of that period. That is, that the CIA was essentially saying that the two sides are, you know, roughly equivalent in terms of strategic power, and that the right and the Air Force clearly supported this point of view, was saying, no, you know, the Soviets are threatening to take, you know, take the lead, and really a throwback to the 1950s and early 1960s when exactly the same thing happened.
Yeah, I can recall these really arcane arguments over deployment of the, I've forgotten what generation missile it was called, but they talked about deploying them in dense, and it was, one of them was called dense pack, where they would put
right. the
missiles, yeah, the MX,
the MX.
Very close together so that in the event of attack, the first warhead going off would cause fratricide with subsequent warheads. And it really got kind of bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, not to spin this out too far, but one of the things that was a sort of a constant theme from the 1950s through the 1980s was the argument by the Air Force and by its supporters outside that the Soviets were, you know, threatening us because they had shelters in their cities. I mean, of course, they had had shelters from the early to mid-1950s. They'd been there all along, and they didn't obviously mean anything in terms of Soviet intentions. That's just, you know, that the Soviets tended to do that because of their experience in World War II. But it was used as a strategic argument against the CIA's estimates of Soviet intentions and Soviet capabilities.
Well, it doesn't give you a lot of faith in the credibility of current military assessments on the part of either the Defense Department or the CIA in terms of, you know, on the one hand, completely missing the boat on Iraq's progress in early 1990s on nuclear weapons and biological weapons and so forth.
Yeah, I would
and
say...
Missing that, and on the other hand, weapons of mass destruction in 2003, of course, they missed it the other way. So
I think that the real point here that you've alluded to, at least indirectly, is that we've had a sea change in the role of the CIA and the intelligence community in the past several years. And this really does go back to the 1980s, though, but it's a problem that's continued to get worse, and that is that the CIA has essentially been politicized. Its estimates, in fact, have been increasingly politicized over the years. Whereas in the 1950s and 1960s, at least up until the Vietnam War began, the CIA really was independent and was able to render objective, reasonably objective judgments about these issues. So I think this is really a very serious change that's taken place, and one that reflects, you know, political changes in this country.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Let's continue here. Our next caller is in Champaign and line two. Hello.
Hello. My question is, I often wondered why during the conduct of the war in Vietnam, we really confined ourselves to South Vietnam. We never really invaded North Vietnam, with the exception perhaps of the airports and some of the bombings. But we did go into Cambodia. We went into Laos. We went into Thailand. But we never went into North Vietnam with ground troops. Given the thesis of a weak communism, why didn't we do that? And secondarily, what difference would it make if we had been able to defeat the VC and invaded North Vietnam and thrown out Ho Chi Minh and so on, given, if you will, that we lost the war, what difference would it have made in the long run if we had won?
That's a very good question. I mean, you are exactly right in posing the question, you know, if communism is so weak, why not attack North Vietnam?
Right.
And I think the answer to that is that, you know, the people who made this war under Kennedy and Johnson, the people who were pushing for war, did not really believe that Vietnam was worth a major conflict. This is absolutely crucial to understanding the history of that war. The Bundys, the McNamaras, the Maxwell Taylors of those two administrations.
Well, what about the Kissingers and the Nixons?
Pardon?
What about the Kissingers and the Nixons with their Christmas bombings of Cambodia and so on? They didn't.
Right. Well, I mean, I would say the same thing about Kissinger and Nixon. I mean, they did not believe that Vietnam was worth a major war. I think in retrospect, I mean, Kissinger recognized that it had been a huge mistake. I think Nixon recognized that it had been a mistake too. But there they were, stuck with them. You know, they already had a major war on their hands, and. So you know, the question of attacking North Vietnam, taking the risk of fighting the Chinese, you know, had to be evaluated within that light. I mean, the point is that none of these people really, you know, believed that South Vietnam was vital to U.S. security. It had become a symbolic issue. You know, the United States doesn't want to lose a war. But, you know, how many people killed is that worth? I think that was at least implicitly underlying the refusal of Lyndon Johnson to carry the war. I mean, he approved the bombing of North Vietnam, but he never really believed in that. And he certainly didn't want to turn it into a war of complete destruction, and he didn't want to send American troops into North Vietnam, which, you know, would have meant a much higher level of casualties, let's face it.
Yeah.
Fighting in North Vietnam would have been much more difficult than fighting in South Vietnam because of logistics.
Yeah, but in the long run, if you will, if you accept that we lost the war in Vietnam, what difference would it have made if we had been able to defeat the VC in the South and the North Vietnamese in the North and thrown out Ho Chi Minh and so on? What difference would it have made in the long run if we had won, given that we didn't?
Exactly.
Communism in the West.
I think that's exactly the right question. I mean, the fact is that it would have made no difference in the nature of politics in Southeast Asia or East Asia. Within by the time that Nixon and Kissinger were trying to salvage something in South Vietnam, they were already making peace with China, and that was supposedly the whole point of our policy in East Asia, was to contain and to threaten and isolate China. And I make the argument in my book that it wasn't the fear of communism in Southeast Asia that motivated the McNamaras and the Bundys and the John McCones, the director of the CIA, and Maxwell Taylor. It was the fear of having to lose the Cold War policy toward China, the policy of surrounding and threatening and hoping for, you know, some sort of breakup of the Chinese regime. That they were afraid they would have to sacrifice that, and that was unacceptable. That's a very poor basis for fighting a war, obviously, and they knew that, and they would never even argue that directly to Lyndon Johnson or to John F. Kennedy. They always made different arguments.
Okay.
Well,
thanks
for the call. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest, Gareth Porter. He's an independent scholar on issues of war and peace and also an historian of the Vietnam conflict. From 1974 through 1976, he was co-director of the Indochina Resource Center in Washington, which carried out research on the war and also lobbied for an end to U.S. military involvement in Indochina. He is the author of the book A Peace Denied, which is the story of the negotiation and implementation of the Paris Peace Agreement of January 1973. He edited a two-volume documentary history of the Vietnam conflict. Also is the author of the book Vietnam, The Politics of Bureaucratic Socialism. That's his analysis of the political system of United Vietnam. And then the book that we're talking about here this morning, which is titled Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. That's the subtitle, and it's published by the University of California Press. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just let me ask you for a question, and have you talk about it, and we'll go back to some other calls. You talked about the fact that, and your assessment is that Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, none of them wanted to send troops to South Vietnam, that there was this struggle between them and the Pentagon, the Joint Chiefs, and also their own national security advisors, the advisors to the president. They were the ones that were pushing for military involvement, and that the presidents simply didn't want to do it. Were there ways in which the national security advisors to the presidents actually misled them, deliberately misled them, in order to push them in the direction of greater military involvement in Vietnam?
The answer is yes. And this was particularly true under Lyndon Johnson. I document in the book the what actually happened in the Gulf of Tonkin in August of 1964, which, you know, historians have always assumed was a decision that Lyndon Johnson, you know, basically was a co-conspirator in, that is to say, misleading the public about what actually happened in the Tonkin Gulf, that, you know, U.S. That the U.S. ships had been attacked a second time, not the first time on August 2nd, but the second time on August 4th. What the documentation that I saw at the Lyndon Johnson Library in Austin, Texas, tells us is that Johnson never knew on August 4th that the naval authorities in the Gulf of Tonkin, the commander of the task force, the naval task force in the Gulf of Tonkin, had begun to change his mind about whether U.S. Ships had been under attack on that day. And he sent back two messages to Washington, which began to backtrack and said he wasn't sure what had happened. And McNamara found out pretty quickly about those messages, and he never told Lyndon Johnson that it was no longer clear that U.S. ships had been under attack. And in fact, there was some doubt about that. So Johnson went ahead with the bombing, believing that that he was still, that his military people in the field believed very firmly that that the U.S. had been under attack. And so, in fact, the authority, the war powers that should be the function of the president were usurped, I would argue, by Robert S. McNamara on that day of August 4th, 1964. That's the most serious one. But there are other cases. By the way, the same thing or something very similar happened 6 weeks later when both Dean Rusk, Secretary of State Dean Rusk, and Robert McNamara tried to convince Johnson that there had been another attack on U.S. vessels in the Gulf of Tonkin. And this time Johnson simply said, no, I'm not going to take your word for it. I want a complete investigation about exactly what happened, and I want to report on it. I'm not going to take action. They tried to convince him that he should again bomb North Vietnam and not wait for a complete investigation report about what had actually happened. And this went on for a day and a half before Johnson finally said he chided McNamara for having done this previously on August 4th, 1964. And Johnson never did agree to that request for bombing of North Vietnam the second time. Now, I also document some other cases where the bureaucracy basically either misled or simply didn't tell the president what he needed to know. One other case was that Dean Rusk never told Lyndon Johnson that the North Vietnamese were willing to sit down and talk peace with the United States without any preconditions. And this was the case from mid-1964 until January 1965, the crucial period of U.S. policymaking. LBJ was clearly under the very strong impression that the North Vietnamese were totally uninterested, unwilling to discuss peace with the United States. And Rusk very clearly allowed him to believe that based on what he told him. He refused to tell LBJ that what he knew about the North Vietnamese willingness to meet with the U.S. So, you know, this was the on the other side, on the diplomatic side, LBJ didn't have the information he needed. Then I also document the fact that JFK, John F. Kennedy, tried to open a negotiating channel with North Vietnam in 1962, which is something that historians have said never happened, that it's always been believed that JFK was dismissive of the idea of negotiating peace with North Vietnam. In fact, he did order the State Department to open a negotiating channel with North Vietnam through India. And what happened was that the top policymaker in the State Department simply sat on it and didn't do it. So this is another case where the president's policy was really being foiled by a bureaucracy that was oriented more towards war.
Well, let's go back here to people who are listening. I think we have some folks who have more questions. We'll go to someone here where we are, Champaign-Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Interesting, but about the proxy war, sort of the opposite comment, like on China and Russia. Foreign Affairs mentioned they both had WMDs but had an unpleasant type of skirmish, if they really did, in 69. And then why should, like two nominal friends in 79, China and Vietnam, have a public skirmish? Why didn't they just work that out peacefully?
So the first part of the question was there really a skirmish in 1969 between Russia and China?
I think that's what the caller was asking.
If I understand the question, as far as I know, the answer is clearly yes, that there was, in fact, a skirmish over the River Ussuri at that point, and that was one of the early indications of how serious the conflict had become between the Soviet Union and China, and certainly prompted American policymakers to begin looking at what that meant.
Hmm.
And then the second part of it was, why didn't China and Vietnam work out their differences in 1979? And at that point, the Chinese were becoming much more assertive about their role in regard to Indochina, and there was a real conflict of national interest between Vietnam and China over the question of Cambodia. I mean, the Vietnamese obviously felt that Cambodia's policy under Pol Pot was a threat to its security interests. For one thing, I mean, they were being attacked across the border by Pol Pot's forces, and ultimately, of course, the Vietnamese then went in with troops into Cambodia and got rid of the Pol Pot regime. And the Chinese, the Chinese government had an alliance with Pol Pot, and so I think they felt, that their prestige was on the line and that they had to teach the Vietnamese a lesson. That seems to be the dynamic that was at work in early 1979.
All right. Hope that gets at the question of the caller. We have another here. Next is Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, that brings up the long historic animosity between China and Vietnam, making it unlikely that a monolithic phenomena would happen. And the previous caller also points out that the Russian and the Chinese were having their own schism, so the whole monolithic thing was a bit of a charade. You were talking earlier about post-war policy in a rather general way, and I wanted to point out that Eisenhower opposed the dropping of the bomb in Nagasaki, Hiroshima, because he thought the war was already over. But I think he also didn't see the other part of what was going on there. Attention, Soviets, we have the bomb, the kind of threat that it was to the Soviet. He also didn't share that estimation, apparently, I think. It would be important to...
Well, you've raised a very important point about Eisenhower, which is that in retrospect, I mean, the man is really a study in contradictions in many ways. I mean, his administration was, on one hand, very aggressive in its anti-communist policy. There's no question about that. It was very assertive, and that includes being assertive in Southeast Asia, particularly. I mean, it was an Eisenhower's policy to become committed, in a sense, I should be very careful about my wording there, it was not a formal legal commitment, but to become deeply involved in militarily and politically in South Vietnam, which of course set up then the situation for JFK and for LBJ to become more deeply involved militarily. On the other hand, Eisenhower was profoundly opposed to getting into a war, unless it was absolutely necessary. He was not one of those who believed that going to war was simply an instrument of foreign policy. And I do think that's a very important attribute of his presidency, that as a military man, I think he was much more cautious about using force than civilians and the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that point in his own administration.
I also don't want to lionize him in any way, because we have Iran and Guatemala and
absolutely
and Cuba, which he set the stage for. Otherwise,
absolutely. You know, on one hand, he did not want to use force. On the other hand, he was very aggressive about exploiting what he understood was the military dominance of the United States over the Soviet Union. And I make the argument that Iran and other covert operations, including the covert operation in South Vietnam in 1955, starting in 54 and 55, to destroy the stay-behind Viet Minh organization, were all made possible, were all made more likely by the imbalance of power between the United States and the Soviet Union. From the point of view of Eisenhower and Dulles and others, there was really no downside to using covert operations to overthrow governments.
Which kind of gets me at the other point I wanted to ask about, which is how much of this taking over the French colonial project, it's a really bizarre story, but the two covert forces between France and the U.S. were actually sort of in their own mini war in some ways on the terrain of Vietnam. But how much did you look at how much the idea of taking over what the French couldn't do kind of idea came in there? And I also, since this is opening up all sorts of discussion, I saw a map at contemporaneous in the Vietnam era of the offshore archipelago and the continental shelf off Vietnam and South China Sea, and all the territory was divided up between French, mainly American and Japanese oil companies. And I'm not saying that it was any kind of single issue, certainly not, but I think the whole grand area strategy, Kennan, et cetera, the idea of having a secondary source for oil that could come directly out of the ocean kind of thing would have been an attractive factor in all the fact that all these corporations had all these declarations of agreements with the Diem government. Seems to me that we rarely hear any discussion of that kind of grand area strategy, natural resource. And I don't think it should be dismissed out of hand. It actually doesn't even get discussed much. So if you could discuss those two things.
I would like to comment on that, but let me come back to your first question about the taking over the French burden. This was really a central element in Eisenhower's vehement opposition to U.S. military intervention. He understood very, very clearly that if the United States had intervened militarily, we would not only hit a wall with the very, very strong, militarily strong Viet Minh, and it would be a very, very difficult fight for U.S. troops, which he didn't think we could win, but he also understood that the Vietnamese would hate us. And he said so. He said so without any ifs, ands, or buts. He stated that if the U.S. intervened, the Vietnamese would transfer their hatred from the French colonialists to the Americans. So it was another very strong motivation for Eisenhower to oppose intervention. And I also should say that John Foster Dulles, who is often credited with being, and I think appropriately so, being a harder line on foreign policy than Eisenhower was, agreed completely with that point of view. He supported Eisenhower in his opposition to intervention. But Dulles did also have a very strong notion about exploiting U.S. dominance to move forward politically in Southeast Asia, specifically in South Vietnam. He believed the United States could afford to move in and convert South Vietnam into an anti-communist bastion because there was no downside, because there was no threat to us from the communist side. They couldn't do anything about it, in other words. Now, as to your point about resources in Southeast Asia, particularly oil resources, I have a very strong view on this that it is a mistake to give any real prominence to the economic interests in the U.S. policymaking on Vietnam. I see no evidence whatsoever in anything that I looked at, either published or unpublished, that any policymaker, any of the presidents or any of the advisors, were even remotely thinking about resources. They were so fixated on the notion of power for its own sake that is power as the dominant position, political military position in Southeast Asia, power in terms of containment of China, in terms of surrounding, pressuring China, that resources were just not on their screen. But that, which is not to say that once you've achieved, you've hoped that you've achieved a position of power, you're not going to use it, you know, for a variety of purposes, including, you know, whatever economic gain that you can get from it. But I'm strongly convinced that Americans need to grasp the notion that, you know, empire, you know, the domination of the world or of specific regions of the world takes place not because of the need or the desire for control of resources, but because power is desired for its own sake. I think that's a much more powerful, if you will, motivator for using military force and for positioning yourself to use military force.
I think we've done a pretty good job. You have done a pretty good job of setting out the basic arguments here. And, of course, people want to read more in greater depth. They can look at the book. The basic arguments being that this was not a case where the United States saw that this was a struggle between equals.
Right.
Between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and China being in the mix, too. But in fact, what this was about was the United States or some people in the United States government seeing clearly the United States as being more powerful and wanting to maintain that power.
Yes, and if I could just go back for
sure,
a moment to
sure.
one of the points that was made by the previous caller about the lack of unity within the communist bloc between the Soviet Union and China, between China and Vietnam. During that period of the Cold War, I just want to emphasize that the evidence is very clear that the U.S. Intelligence community and the policymakers themselves were very, very aware of the disunity within the communist bloc. And that was just another reason, on top of the military imbalance, as to why they were so confident that the United States could intervene either by sending troops to South Vietnam in 1960-61-62 or by bombing North Vietnam without facing any threat of a major war.
Is it, one of the things I guess I'm interested in is how is it that this your analysis, your approach to looking at this seems to be relatively new or fresh. Is it the case that the support for this argument is there? It's been there all along. It's just a matter of actually going and looking for it.
It's a very, very good question. And I think your answer is exactly right, that the evidence has been there all along. But historians in this country have not been looking for it. They've been mesmerized, I think, by the idea, which still remains to this day the dominant interpretation of that period of the Cold War, that there was, in fact, a balance of power between the superpowers, and that Vietnam was, in some sense, the product of that struggle between these two titanic powers. That has exercised such a dominant influence over historians that I think that they're just not looking for that evidence. And you know, I think one of the lessons of my book is that you have to begin by reexamining the fundamental paradigm, the fundamental assumptions. Otherwise, you're not going to find the truth.
Yeah. And just to finish up here, I can give you about a minute. I do, again, though, want to connect that time with now, because you do and have made the argument that there are some parallels between the way the United States operated here and the United States' involvement in Iraq.
Yes, the lesson that I think we have to take away from this reexamination, if you will, of why we went to war in Vietnam, is that having dominant power globally is not an unalloyed plus for the United States. And indeed, I would argue that it does present serious dangers to the security of the United States, of the American people, because it tempts policymakers from time to time to go to war in situations where they shouldn't. The way I would put it, I didn't write this in the book, but I would say too much power makes you stupid. By that I mean it makes you intellectually lazy. You don't really look carefully at all the factors that you should be examining. And you start thinking that the hierarchy of conventional military power is really all there is to be examined. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in Vietnam. That's what happened again in Iraq.
There we must leave it. If people want to read more in depth, the book is titled Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power and the Road to War in Vietnam by our guest, Gareth Porter. He's an independent scholar on issues of war and peace, historian of the Vietnam conflict. Mr. Porter, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, David, for having me.